It is Friday, April the 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, North Korea and the Islamic State, hot topics at the nuclear summit.
2 years ago, at the nuclear security summit, essentially no one had ever heard of the Islamic State. Within months of the 2014 nuclear security summit, they had declared a global caliphate.
Also ahead, press freedom on trial in Turkey, South Africa's leader failing to uphold the Constitution, plus a renowned Iraqi architect dies. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Obama says that in the wake of attacks in places including Brussels, there is not only great urgency around the nuclear issue by eliminating generally the scourge of terrorism. He commented Thursday on the sidelines of the Nuclear Security Summit here in Washington. Also, Mr. Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping pledged to cooperate to confront the North Korean nuclear threat. Mr. Obama acknowledged the world remains imperiled by Pyongyang's nuclear agenda.
Of great importance to both of us is North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons, which threatens the security and stability of the region. And President Xi and I are both committed to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and full implementation of UN sanctions.
The nuclear summit here in Washington, the security summit, is the fourth and final such summit for President Obama. Nicholas Roth is a research associate at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. He's attending the nuclear summit and discussed with VOA's Victor Beatty the importance of the meeting.
For the last 6 years, countries around the world have come together, dozens of countries, focused on the effort to secure nuclear weapons material around the world. Every 2 years, there have been summits where countries have made pledges to strengthen their own security. They've shared information about how they would do that. These summits have elevated the issue of strengthening nuclear security around the world. And at this summit, which will be the final summit, it's essential that countries agree to a plan that continues strengthening nuclear security without summits in place. At this year's summit, countries are going to agree to 5 action plans that will focus on sustaining nuclear security efforts through a variety of different organizations. And it's essential that coming out of this summit, that countries have a roadmap on how to go forward, that countries make concrete commitments to strengthening nuclear security in their own countries, but also that there is a path forward.
Is one of the big issues the fact that terror groups like Islamic State could obtain a so-called dirty bomb?
The issue of the threat is a very important one. 2 years ago, at the Nuclear Security Summit, essentially no one had ever heard of the Islamic State. Within months of the 2014 Nuclear Security Summit, they had declared a global caliphate. And what we've seen over the last 2 years is that while there's no solid evidence that a group like the Islamic State is pursuing nuclear weapons capability, if they did so, they have land, they have resources, they have global outreach, they have apocalyptic ideology, and they've demonstrated that they're capable of carrying out sophisticated attacks around the world. So if they decided to go down that route, they have as much capability as any terrorist group in history to do so. And I think that really highlights the speed at which threats can change and the need for securing nuclear material.
Nicholas, what about rogue states like North Korea and its pursuit of nuclear weapons, as well as states that seem to be failing or having great difficulty that are already nuclear armed like Pakistan?
There are a number of countries that are of significant concern with regard to nuclear security. In a recent report that I helped co-author, we talk about 3 countries in particular, Russia, Pakistan, and India. And there are a number of very specific threats that all countries should guard against in terms of threats, insider threats, outsider threats involving more than one group of people, having a robust security culture. And it's important that organizations with nuclear materials and nuclear facilities are prepared to protect against those threats, but also that they understand them as well.
And as Harvard's Nicholas Roth, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Now it's time to check in with International Edition social media correspondent G. Abby Lee, who's here. Checking in with you now, G., on what's happening online about this nuclear summit. What do you think is the best hashtag to keep informed about the summit?
Hi, Steve. It's hashtag NSS2016. That stands for the Nuclear Security Summit 2016, and that's also the handle on Twitter for this year's event. The account sent out some 130 tweets so far, but already has nearly 900 followers.
Yeah, 900 followers, that's pretty good. I see, G. You know, the White House and the State Department, I noticed, were tweeting throughout the day about all of this. What about some of the specific officials?
Secretary of State John Kerry tweeted, "Proud to join the president at hashtag NSS2016 today. Opportunity to advance a vision he outlined in Prague of stopping the spread of nuclear weapons." Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz was also prolific on Twitter Thursday. His handle is at Ernest Moniz, that's M-O-N-I-Z. He tweeted, "This is important. The president hosts the fourth nuclear security summit this week. There has been real progress since the first." And then he replied to his own tweet to state facts that support the statement. Now, just to tell you a couple, he said, "The number of facilities with nuclear material continues to decline, and that 15 countries have opened new centers for nuclear security training and international cooperation since 2009.
Well, we couldn't leave the subject of what's happening in the world of social media without looking at the U.S. political scene. What's happening there?
The GOP presidential frontrunner Donald Trump had a surprise meeting with RNC, or the Republican National Committee, here in D.C. After the meeting, he tweeted, "Just had a very nice meeting with RNC Chief Reince Priebus and the Republican Party. Looking forward to bringing the party together, and it will happen." More than 14,000 people liked that tweet. Priebus did not tweet about the meeting, but here's an interesting reply to Trump's tweet. Women for Trump 2016, whose handle is at DEBDEW2 on Twitter, wrote, "They better treat you with respect, Mr. Trump. We won't allow their evil, selfish plans." Dozens of people liked that tweet. Steve?
There you go. Many thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can find G on Twitter. Please follow her at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. Coming up, we'll have more on the U.S. presidential race. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
"This is a problem that inflicts almost every country."
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. In Turkey, a car bomb attack has left 6 police officers dead and at least 23 others wounded in the Kurdish-majority southeastern city of Diyarbakir. There's been no claim of responsibility so far. An offshoot of the Kurdistan Workers' Party claimed 2 car bombing attacks earlier this year in the capital, Ankara. While we're on that subject of Turkey, there is growing concern there about media freedom. National and international attention is now focused on the case of Erdem Gül and Can Dündar. The journalists face 2 consecutive life sentences plus 30 years behind bars for publishing a story accusing the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of being behind arms shipments to Syrian jihadists. Dorian Jones met with Dündar, the editor-in-chief of the newspaper Cumhuriyet, on the eve of his next hearing set for today.
As he penned his column, editor-in-chief Can Dündar said he's all too aware the peace for Cumhuriyet could be one of the last, he writes, as a free man.
"Yeah, I'm prepared for a long imprisonment, maybe. But it's a political issue, it's a political struggle, and you have to be ready for any kind of price to be paid, because this is the way democracy can overcome, you know. Otherwise, if we stop talking, that means a kind of silent society, which Erdogan needs and pushes for that. So we have to stay and fight back.
At issue is a video shot by Turkish paramilitary police during a raid on Syria-bound aid trucks that were being escorted by Turkish intelligence agents. Police discover munitions on the trucks. Dundina's colleague Erdem Gül reported the arms were for Syrian jihadists. Their story and the decision to show the video on their newspaper's webpage drew the ire of President Erdogan, who pledged they would pay a heavy price. He says the trucks carry legitimate aid to ethnic Turkmen communities in Syria, and the newspaper engaged in espionage in publishing it. Shortly after that, prosecutors opened cases against them for espionage and membership in a terror organization. Dündar rejects the charges.
It was an international crime for the Turkish government and the president and Turkish intelligence services, trafficking arms towards a neighboring country and to get involved in civil war there. And that's why, as a journalist, it was my responsibility to publish it.
In March, one of Turkey's best-selling newspapers, Zaman, a strong critic of Erdogan's government, was seized by the courts on allegations it was supporting terrorism. Concern is growing over the future of Cumhuriyet, one of Turkey's last mainstream newspapers critical of the government. Dündar says he worries that Ankara is being given a free hand by its Western allies.
Europe, from the beginning, were supporting Erdogan because of the flow of immigrants, you know, the crisis. And that gives Erdogan a free hand to use over us and suppress us in Turkey. And it was a big disappointment for Turkish Democrats and liberals, you know.
Many European diplomats attended the last court hearing for the two journalists, a move strongly condemned by the president. How far Europe will go in risking its relationship with its key ally over press freedom remains unclear. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
South Africa's Constitutional Court has ordered President Jacob Zuma to repay some of the $16 million in public funds used for upgrades at his private home. The ruling Thursday came as authorities investigate Mr. Zuma for another more recent scandal, alleged undue influence given to the wealthy Gupta family. For some analysis of all of this, VOA's Joda Kapwa spoke to Stephen Friedman, director of the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Johannesburg in Rhodes. Friedman first addresses the constitutional issues involved in the court's ruling against President Zuma.
There are two constitutional issues at the heart of this case, which are related to each other. The one which is not getting much publicity because everybody's focused on the future of the president is the role of the public protector. The incumbent is supposed to protect the interests of the public and to ensure that government acts in a way that is accountable to the public. And for much of the time that this office has been there since 1994, it's been assumed that the public protector can only recommend, that the public protector cannot enforce government to do what she finds. What the court has now decided is that her findings, well, the person in charge now is a woman, maybe it'll be a man in the future, but the public protector's findings are now binding. That means that government has to obey them unless it challenges them in court. And parliament has to obey them unless it challenges it in court. The other issue is, of course, relates to, did the president and parliament defy the constitution or refuse to uphold the constitution by not implementing the recommendations of the public protector? And, of course, the court found that that was the case. The court didn't say that they did it deliberately. It was outside his mandate to do that.
Professor, this seems to be an issue of checks and balances that might be new to the South African government. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, what we're seeing here is a fascinating process. You know, people who are used to these checks and balances, there are, of course, some countries where they've been enforced for many years, tend to forget that even in those countries where they've been there for many years, they were very difficult to establish in the first place and were challenged later on. The reason for that, of course, is that there's nothing natural or automatic about the idea that people in positions of political power should have to limit their power by listening to the courts, by allowing the media to be free, by accepting all sorts of limits on their power which come with democratic government. People who hold political power challenge these rules, or they try to push the rules and try to find how much they can get away with. And then what happens to your society really depends on whether that is successful or not. And what is happening in South Africa at the moment, very interestingly, despite a lot of pessimism from many people, is that those who are trying to push against the rules are not winning.
Professor, here in the United States, our highest court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has been accused at times of being political. Do you see those accusations at all being leveled against South Africa's constitutional court?
Well, the odd thing, in a sense, is that they haven't been leveled against the court. And the reason I say it's an odd thing is that I think all constitutional courts are political. I mean, whether you're talking about your court in America or you're talking about the German court, what many constitutional democracies do is to put in place procedures which recognize that it's political, so that you need confirmation by Congress in your case, or the Germans have a system where you balance it. If you appoint a judge from the governing party, you have to appoint a judge from the opposition party. And therefore, you know, it's acknowledged in most countries that constitutional courts are political. And what you try to do is to make sure that your system balances this by making sure that everybody's represented.
What does this ruling mean for future South African presidents and the parliament?
They've been told quite clearly that this office of the public protector, which has become a very popular office in this country, that this office is now protected by the Constitution.
That's Stephen Friedman, director of the Center for the Study of Democracy at the University of Johannesburg and Rhodes University. He was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. U.S. Republican Party presidential frontrunner Donald Trump finds himself under fire for comments that he made about abortion and over his defense of his top campaign aide, who is charged with battery. National correspondent for VOA Jim Malone reports that Trump's difficulties come at a crucial time in the Republican primary contest.
Donald Trump remains on the defensive over comments he made to MSNBC host Chris Matthews that women who have abortions should be punished if abortion were outlawed.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
I don't know. You take positions and everything else.
I do take positions and everything else. It's a very complicated position.
Trump later issued a statement that said if abortion does become illegal, abortion providers should be the ones punished, not the women. Trump is also under fire for defending campaign manager Corey Lewandowski after he was charged with battery after allegedly grabbing a reporter's arm at a recent campaign event.
And I know it'd be very easy for me to discard people. I don't discard people. I stay with people. That's why I stay with this country.
Republican rival Ted Cruz was quick to slam Trump over the abortion issue.
You know, that comment was wrong. And it really, it's the latest demonstration of how little Donald has thought about any of the serious issues facing this country.
Ohio Governor John Kasich said Trump was not qualified to be president.
Donald Trump is clearly not prepared to be president of the United States. And I have to tell you that as a commander-in-chief and leader of the free world, you don't get do-overs. You need to be able to get it right the first time.
Trump was also denounced by Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton, campaigning in New York.
If you make abortion a crime, then you make women and doctors criminals. I'm always struck by the fact that these Republicans all want limited government except when it comes to women's rights.
And by her rival, Bernie Sanders, on MSNBC.
One would say, what is in Donald Trump's mind, except we're tired of saying that. I don't know what world this person lives in.
The turmoil for Trump comes ahead of Tuesday's primary in Wisconsin, where polls show Cruz is leading, and amid growing concerns that Trump would be a weak nominee in the general election, says John Fortier.
But Donald Trump is a different kind of candidate. He has a different constituency, brings out different sort of people, and it's a very tough and incivil campaign. It is a time of a real Republican questioning. Donald Trump will be a different kind of nominee and somewhat divisive.
Trump remains ahead in the delegate count, but a stumble in Wisconsin could increase the chances of a contested and divisive Republican convention in July. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And for more on U.S. politics, check out our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
9, 8. Sound effects, optical illusions. Is that wall moving?
You have a combination of the food with an atmosphere and special experience, so you're part of something very special.
Alexandra Brew is a diner from France at this one-of-a-kind restaurant in Shanghai. Ultraviolet literally marries effect with food. Founder and head chef Paul Perret.
The ambiance that will be surrounding a dish and will be tailored on a specific dish.
Behind the scenes, a nerve center controls every visual, sound, and scented effect designed to enhance each edible course. And there are 20 of them.
The moving wall was insane.
Inside the kitchen, the staff might blow torch course 5 or moisten your palate with vaporized iodine water. Ultraviolet serves just 10 people, but this unique experience will cost about $1,000 a person. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexia.
This is VOA's International Edition. The world's most famous female architect, 65-year-old Baghdad native Zaha Hadid, whose groundbreaking designs included the Aquatic Center for the London 2012 Games and a stadium for the 2022 Qatar World Cup, has died. A heart attack took Hadid's life at a Miami hospital here in the U.S. where she was being treated for bronchitis. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with architect Thomas Leslie, the Picard Chilton Professor at Architecture at Iowa State University, about Hadid's contributions, not only to architecture, but humanity.
She was, she came out of a background in painting, and I think really offered a kind of freedom or the idea of a freedom for architectural form and architectural meaning that was very, very new, especially in the 1980s. I think also you can't underestimate the fact that she was a very strong female figure in a field that that needs those. And she was also, I think, one of the architects who really showed how architecture can be an important part of sort of international marketing, international branding, that architecture is a way for countries and corporations to make statements about their outlook was increasingly important at the end of last century, the beginning of this one.
She is known for the Italian National Museum of 21st Century Art in Rome, the Rosenthal Center for Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, and even the Guangzhou Opera House in China. She also was a winner of the Pritzker Architecture Prize. Now, what exactly is that?
Well, the Pritzker is often referred to as architecture's Nobel Prize. It's given annually to a living architect who has been the most influential over the past generation, who the committee feels has really set the agenda. And it was a remarkable moment when she won. She was the first woman to win, and it seemed long overdue at the time when she received it.
And she also was a teacher. She was handing on her knowledge to other people as well. Isn't that correct?
That's true. She taught extensively, and I think that, in addition to the buildings, that's certainly one of her most powerful legacies. Her students, of course, went on to great things, many of them in the vein of the kind of exuberant formalism that she was known for, many, I think, also slightly in rebellion against that. But I think as a student, it always helps to have a strong figure that you can either work with or you can work against in your career. And she was very powerful in that sense.
And her designs speak beyond their years as well. Looking at the Aquatic Center in London and some of her other designs, she broke some barriers, and people are probably going to be studying her work for years, right?
That's absolutely the case. Her work was, as I said, exuberant and often at odds with structural or constructional, what we might have regarded as structural or constructional truths, also occasionally at odds with the context, usually in ways that were provocative and interesting, sometimes in ways that drew controversy, but always in ways that grabbed attention, both for the architecture and for the spaces around them. And I think the power of her forms, as I said, was often at odds with some of the things that architects and sometimes urban planners hold dear. And that, I think, you know, her legacy will be as someone who poked and prodded at things that we took for granted for generations. Her work will absolutely be studied years into the future, both for what it promised and also, I think, what it rebelled against.
As Thomas Leslie, a professor of architecture at Iowa State University, he was speaking with my colleague David Byrd. Academy Award winner Michael Douglas is donating his personal collection of more than 36 film prints to the George Eastman Museum in the U.S. state of New York. Officials at the Photography Museum, located on the estate of Kodak's founder, says the Douglas collection includes films he starred in or produced. He won the Oscar for Best Picture for producing the 1975's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He won also the Academy Award for Best Actor in 1987's Wall Street. Those two films are among the donated prints. Others include The China Syndrome, Romancing the Stone, and Traffic. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay with us for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
It's 4 hours.